seconds watching the spinny thing spin, and hopefully not infinitely, and it finally kicked over. Anyway, just a few moments late with the start of your Monday Mayhem. Monday Mayhem, for those that didn't catch it last week, these are like throwback shows, right? This is like going back to the early days. This is riffing off the cuff, variety of topics like I used to do in 40 to 60 minutes in the car, hauling ass down the street. Don't even tell you what I'm going to talk about when I come on. I just go right on into it. So let's do that today, right? And so what are we going to start off with today? Well, before we even start off, just remember, if you are catching a live stream, you can ask questions, you can comment, and I will try not to forget that I do that this week, like I did last week, my first Monday Mayhem. If you put all caps comment or question at the beginning of your comment or question, if I see it, I will click the star, and then if I remember, I will cover it at the end. That's what the little words at the bottom mean. If you're like, hey, I'd like to be in a live stream, how do I do that? Get on our Telegram channel. There's other ways to do it, but if you're on the Telegram channel, you'll get a little alert every morning about that day's live stream, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday anyway, because that's the days we do live streams. All right, where are we going today? We're going to start off with just something I observed, and I've observed this to be more and more true over the years. Americans now see disability, and I don't mean the actual disability, like something really, like they don't really want something to be wrong with them, but if it is, they'll use it, and if not, if they can fabricate it, if there is something wrong, but they could work anyway, but they don't really want to work, disability retirement plan. I mean, where else can you retire at like 28, 32 years of age for the rest of your life with guaranteed income? Other than America on some form of disability. One way or another. And I'm not even including things here like, yes, there are women that milk the WIC program, okay? And the Section 8, I'm talking about, I can't work because insert reason here, so give me money every month. And this process is laborious, but I guess it's worth it for a lifetime income, right? And what I'm talking about is, you know, my back, I hurt my back. I lost my foot to diabetes or whatever. And all I get was like, I was a contractor at Lockheed back in the 90s. There was this dude that, like, he basically had use of his right hand for his chair, and he had some controls with his mouth, and he could use his hands but not really his arms. He had, well, like, this elevator that let him down out of the vehicle that somebody drove him to work in, and he worked every day and did something useful. And if he could work, then a lot of these people could work. And the reason I'm talking about this is I mentioned this, I think it was on X, somewhere on social this weekend, and somebody said, well, in a society that's corrupt like ours, that's what smart people do. And then this person wasn't a sleaze because they were like, if I had no morals, I would too, but I can't be a parasite. So he wasn't saying like this is a noble goal. He was saying, I understand why people do it, and I guess I do too. And when I think about, like I said, this is built over the years. Let me explain what I mean by this. I knew this guy. His name was Patrick. He does not make knives, to be clear. And I knew him through an association that doesn't really matter, but it was based on business. And this guy was about my age, maybe a year older, maybe a year younger, but somewhere, you know, 2 or 3 years on either side of it. And we kind of lost touch for about 10 years. And he hits me up on instant message one day and says, hey, how are you doing? Blah, blah, blah. And he goes, I'm retired now. And I was thinking, like, this guy was an entrepreneur, but he wasn't really very good at it. But maybe he hit a home run. So I start asking him about it. Well, no, he got on disability and he considered himself retired. And I go all the way back to the 80s. There was this guy that worked for my dad. Well, my dad ran a tire shop named Roger, and Roger's brother had Roger run over his foot with a forklift to get on disability, which almost worked, but somehow thing got back some way and they found out what he did. And so he ended up with a crushed, damaged forever foot. He was legitimately disabled and no disability money. And that what happened next, I don't know, right? Like, how much of this can we tolerate before we break? We're $40 trillion in debt, if you didn't pay attention to that little landmark thing happen. And a lot of this money does go to pay this kind of thing. Now, it's the biggest welfare recipients in the country are corporations. I acknowledge that. It doesn't matter. These are still real numbers we're talking about here. And I would tell you that there's probably at least a dozen that I know of, people that I went to high school with, who are on disability of some sort now. And I bet you half of the people I graduated with are on some form of assistance, but I'm only talking about full-on disability and retirement. But here's what I said to the person, and I find this very sad. It's personally limiting once you do this. So when I think about that, I guess if you're going to spend your entire life, you know, I don't know, working at Quickie Mart or cleaning toilets at a hotel for minimum wage or something like that, like $2,500 a month for life and maybe some other freebies from the government, maybe, I guess I understand if that's your full potential, why you would do this. But I just look at that and go, you know, if I offered you a job right now paying you $3,000 a month, would you take it? Most of you would say no. Maybe you would have said yes 20 years ago. And I don't just mean because you were younger and needed a job more. I mean because you could actually live on, what is that, 36 grand a year. You know, when I started the show, I said kind of a base level income that any competent person should be able to obtain by the time they're in their mid-20s is about $40,000 a year. And that was 2008. And I actually got a lot of hate mail for that early on. There wasn't that many of y'all. And I still had a significant amount of hate mail saying, not just everybody can do that. I didn't say everybody could. I said everybody should be able to do that. Right. But today, 40 grand a year, unless you have a two-income household, right, that's poverty shit. And it shouldn't be. But remember one of my laws of life. What is more important than what should be, and what will be is more important than what should become, right? Like, that doesn't matter. So all I'm pointing out here is that these folks, yeah, they might get some food stamps on top of that, maybe. They probably will get on some sort of Medicaid or something. And I'm not putting down anybody that's there for legitimate reasons. Like, that was your final option, so you took it. However, once you're on that, you can't really make any money. Like, even the guys that are disability out of the military, like, they can go on and do something else. Most of these people have, like, these federal programs that are declared disabled. If you go out and start earning other income, they say, well, apparently you're not disabled at all. You don't need that anymore, which in itself could be a problem. But just straight out of the gate, to me, a person who's willing to sell the rest of their life for $2,500 a month, which is, what, about $30,000 a year? What potential did you give up? And Rogue TSP here says, welcome to Costco. I love you. And that's the society we're creating. That's the society we're creating. To be fair, you know what? At least that dude had a job. At least he did something. He stood at the front of Costco, which was like 8 square miles of store in the fictitious future, and told people he loved them. At least he did something. He stood on his feet all day, right? Like, They still have people in Costco now that stand there to make sure you're a member coming in, but you swipe your card. I don't think – whatever. Anyway, let's move on from there. Let's welcome or honor or recognize, I guess is the best word for it, our two sponsors of the day today. Sponsor of the day number one today is canineacademy.us. That is Joel Riles. Online university to help you learn how to train your dog the right way. I've known Joel a long time now, and he has really helped me become a better dog trainer, and I wasn't exactly bad at it to begin with. He also has an online problem-solving library, which is like a free course you can take. You'll learn a lot in it. You'll get a feel for what the other courses are like, but I recommend everybody at least take the core obedience module because that will be 90% of what you need for most of you. Like, if you're not actually trying to train an active production dog or a livestock guardian dog or something like that, if you just want a dog that's a good citizen in your home, that core basics will teach you everything you know to get that. And once you know the methodology, then you can adapt it to other needs, you know, whether it's a dog that you want to teach to be a good hunting dog or whatever. But it's core obedience that prevents them from eating your chickens, jumping on people, taking a deuce on the floor, et cetera. Check it out, canineacademy.us. And next up today, The Case Place. The Case Place is this really awesome company that's been around for about 10 years now. And what they do is they actually buy excess inventory and they repair items that were returned on warranty and things like that. Or they also sometimes buy surplus from like law enforcement organizations that bought more than they needed and they're trying to clear their inventory out. And they offer these amazing military and law enforcement grade hard cases from companies like Pelican, Hardig, and SKB for 50 to 80% off. And I mean, I'm looking at, no, I'm not looking right now. I looked up this weekend, one of the cases that Costco is actually selling because we had to go there and it was like 200 and something bucks. And they have pretty much the same case at the Case Place for like 98 bucks. So I think that's just indicative of what a great deal is, because Costco is already known for selling things at discounts. That's a huge discount. And the reason I think you should be looking at hard cases like this is the value of the gear that they're designed to protect, whether it's your guns and ammo that go with them and service equipment, optics, camera gear, electronic gear, et cetera. If you move around with your gear's expensive. You're going to want to protect it. But there's no reason to pay more for it than you have to, right, guys, gals? So check out the Case Place. And if you're an MSB member, you get another 10% off. And if you're not an MSB member, use the banner on the site. I don't have an affiliate agreement or anything there, but the deal with that is if you use the banner on the site, you'll see the discount code on the landing page that you get 5% off even if you're not a member. All right, moving on. Let's talk about expensive beef. There's been a lot of talk about that lately. And what got me to talk about this was a post by my buddy Billy Bond, the permaculture pimp, P-I-M-P, right? Permaculture is my passion. And by the way, Billy sent me, if I remember, I'll put it in the show notes. Billy sent me a video from about a year ago that he did in Asheville, panhandling as a joke. And in about 20 minutes, he made like 80 bucks or something. He worked it out. It was like 200 something dollars an hour. He went out, and it was hysterical. He said the woketards in Asheville still hate him for what he did, but I might link to that for you guys. But anyway, so he made this post about Trump saying they were going to be importing beef product to drive down specifically the cost of ground beef, and some of that would be coming from Europe. And Billy's a very skeptical guy, and I appreciate that about him. And he's like, what is beef product? Like, in other words, like, is this actually something we should be eating? The truth is, if it's coming from Europe, it's probably better than what you get in the store right now. But this is part of the problem indicative to the cost of beef in this country. We actually have a shitload of beef. Now, people say it's only 20%, and I believe that to be a lie because it's disproportionate. And when I explain everything I have explained today, it'll make sense why it's disproportionate. But we send, and we send mostly high-end cuts. Think ribeyes, think tenderloins, and stuff like that. A shitload of beef to Asia, specifically South Korea and Japan, and to Europe. Now, people say, we can't send it to Europe because they ban GMOs. Yes, we send our best cuts of our grass-fed beef to Europe because we grow a lot of grass-fed beef. But go to the grocery store and look for grass-fed beef. And what will you see is country of origin marking on the ones that actually do it? Argentina, Australia, Brazil. Because we send our best cuts, the high-value cuts, the things that end up on restaurant plates, we send it overseas. And what this does, and this is why it's disproportionate, 20%, we keep the rest, we turn it into ground, right? But the thing is that we send those cuts over as primals. There's no trim off of them. Now, Europe grass feeds almost all its beef. In fact, they do grass feed all their beef because GMOs are illegal. So even though you can feed them corn or whatever, you're feeding them non-GMO, but they just choose mostly to finish on grass, which makes a lot of sense. You know, Europe occasionally gets one in the wind column, and that's one for them. So what they end up with is an assload of really lean trim, not primals. That's why it's product. No, it's not Pink Slime. Let it go. This is not Pink Slime. This is actually, it's much more important you understand the problem than try to dunk on like fat quality nutrition. We have, because we take our cattle and put them in feedlots and shove corn into them to fatten them for 8 weeks at the end of their miserable existence, an abundance of fat. Now, when you go buy ground beef, you're not looking for like 50-50. You can't even sell 50-50 ground beef. I think 70-30 is the like the most fat content ground beef you can sell legally in the United States and call it ground beef. And most people are looking for 80-20 to 90-10. That's what people want to buy. So we have so much fat, we import lean to mix to make our ground beef. And so we're going to import more. Now, traditionally, American ranchers are opposed to importing beef for obvious reasons, but that ain't what they're opposed to. And the whole thing is so convoluted. But the real problem here, do you understand what the real problem is? Why our beef so expensive? We literally have a country that was naturally by itself a buffalo factory, right? 65 million buffalo running from Texas up to Canada and back in a migration pattern in a belt about as wide as the state of Nebraska, right? And that was just one big animal. Like there was all this other megafauna, you know, even after losing everything we lost in the Holocene and the Younger Dryas and stuff like that, we still had like elk, like wait, we have like four species of elk, two or three of which are now extinct, right? We have way more deer and way more mule deer than we have today as well in this country. So we can support ruminants, right? So what's the problem? The problem is processing. I see posts from people that have no knowledge of what you speak, John Dowie, saying, look at the ranchers. I don't feel for the ranchers. They keep reducing their headcount and living off the kid of government. Hey, John, go try it. I love John, but in this case, you just don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Go try it. Go show us how to do it then. Here's the problem. You get this beef to finish weight. You got to sell it. Then you got this incredibly narrow bottleneck, right? When you go to process this, like Cargill companies have a cartel and they maintain a very strict bottleneck on how much beef can come through in the name of your safety. Okay. And so what we need is lots of small regional slaughterhouses that are processing beef for people to eat. And if we had that, then we'd have more cattle because it would be easy to get your meat processed locally. So you would load up your trailer as a rancher that's running like, you know, putting out like 20 head of beef a year, and you would take them down there and then they would get processed and they get sold, you know, in some manner, right? Because you can do it. I'm about to get into how you can do it, but it ain't easy. And because there's a limit to how much that these guys are able to process locally, like how much market there is, okay, they're all like, it's still expensive to set up a facility for this. It's not cheap. So most of these places around here make their money, yes, on people like me that buy from a guy down the road and some stuff like that, or, you know, do a processing run of chickens for the customer. So they're direct processing fewer. That's okay. But they make a lot of their money processing venison. They also bring in primals and run, you know, front case meat shops. That's what they do. There's a place out in Weatherford. It's exactly how they operate. But I want you to think about this. When the government says, it's for your safety. You got to have these people in charge for your safety. Okay, retards, explain this to me then. Millions of freaking deer shot every year, okay? And in states like Texas, a lot of those deer are shot when it's freaking 80 degrees out, yeah? Johnny the Hunter guts his deer, throws the guts in the field, throws a rope around his neck, drives on the road, pitches the deer in the back of the truck, and maybe sticks like a 20-pound bag of ice in the cavity. Johnny drives his truck freaking 3 hours back home. About 10 o'clock at night, he swings by the processing facility, throws the deer on the freaking ground, fills out a form and ties it to the deer. And the guy gets a phone call a week later saying, yeah, we've had your deer hanging already. How do you want it parted out? They parted out, and he drug it through the dirt. He drove it home in the back of a truck, with the hide on it. He left it overnight. How many people get sick from that a year? Freaking goose egg. Nobody. If one person got really sick and ended up in the hospital or died from eating venison processed that way, oh my God, CNN, Fox News, alert, don't do it. It's bullshit. If that's okay, then a facility set up with hanging coolers and everything else can process freaking beef safely. How is it that I and hundreds of others use this facility out in Weatherford and none of us get sick, none of us get beef, none of us die? It's all bullshit. So what are some things we could be doing? Understand we're using a manufactured crisis here to enforce a multi-million dollar rule on local processors. In other words, they can't build a facility. They don't have the capital. It doesn't exist. And again, the hypocrisy is just Texas. 350,000 deer a year are processed the way I just explained. It's more like 900,000 with self-processing and other stuff. But about 350,000 deer a year in Texas are thrown in the back of a butcher shop intact, other than gutted. Because that's the one thing they will require of you, right? I can't kill my own cow and take it down there to have it cut up. I have to bring them the cow alive, but I can throw a deer at the back door, and that's okay. So what can we do about this? One, we can use the custom exempt loophole. By law, the government cannot expect meat you already own. If you already own it, right? You must write two separate checks, one to the rancher for the live animal and one to the processing facility. This is what I do. I never want a whole beef at one time because I don't have the space for it. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't have a space for a half. And I always want to get my beef after my fall workshop because right now my freezers are just building. But the way that works is I tell him, yeah, I'll buy half from you this year. But I don't have another person. He's like, no, I got it. And he'll take somebody from his customer list and he'll match us. And we each write him a check separately. And when we write that check to him, right? Actually, we write him two checks. One's like a deposit, but it's an initial purchase fee. And the other one's like a bonus. So once it gets processed, they weigh our half and they add that to the deposit that we paid on the animal, like financing the animal. But you drive the car off the lot, you own it, like that. And then, because that's a true hangway, we pay him the differential, right? Or he refunds us. So that never happens. He doesn't take much in the deposit. And then we pay the processor to do the processing. So it's our animal. It's like the two of us went together, raised the cow, and took it down there. But that the farmer just happened to drive it down there for us. So that's a well-known one. But the problem is it's very limiting. And you can do it with quarter beef. But a quarter beef in this model may not really be worth it because you probably don't just want ground and roast. You probably want those prime cuts. And when you're talking about a quarter of a beef and you're talking like your ribeyes, you're talking like four ribeyes. Okay. Just to kind of give you an idea here. Then there's the cow share limited liability corporation model. And this is where we saw the storage issue. 10 families could say legally buy shares in a company. Now they become owners of the company. Right. They can have and the farmer doing this can set it up where they have non-voting ownership rights in the company. Right? They used to have some ownership in the company. And this drops the buy-in from an entire beef down to an affordable, let's say, 30 pounds per cycle. That can even be set up. I wouldn't do this with a co-op, but it can be more co-op like. OK. And what I mean by that is you can have big freezers as a storage on-site facility. And people will come in and pick up their shares as necessary. That way you can consolidate processing down to on-farm or a local facility, and the farmer brings it back, and you already owned it. You already owned a part of it. You're a partial owner. Then there's private membership associations. Now, I'm going to tell you that I think PMAs, there's a lot of people, I hate to use the term, but on our side of a lot of freedom issues that are overselling what a PMA can do. Wholesale overselling it, you know, almost to the point of like, you can sell heroin on your place if you're a PMA, you know, and there's a lot of bullshit about how you can market a PMA, but done properly, You can take your food supply off grid with a PMA here. You can take transactions into a private club where the members exchange herd shares completely out of the jurisdiction of public inspectors. And what I mean by that is it's similar to the farmer model, but it may be that the club itself just takes the first model I gave you. The club writes the check for, let's say, 3 cows. The club maintains a facility for storage, and then members are able to purchase pieces, parts, and cuts from that PMA. That works, and it's virtually bulletproof. I want to say in all these models, you need to check your state and local laws. There's some really stupid states, and there's some really free states, and it's not the way you think. A lot of places where it's really a lot of gun freedom and entrepreneurship freedom clamp down on shit like this. And a lot of places that you think of as being social and shit, I have some pretty big loopholes designed for this type of stuff. So be careful with it. And then mobile slaughter units. I actually had a gal on that does this. This is where you have a certified truck or trailer, basically, that goes on site and butchers and process the animal on the ranch where the consumer legally bought it. Now, the way she was doing it, basically, you need your cow or two processed. She came out and did it for you. However, there's no reason that these can't be blended together where one farm becomes the nucleus and everybody's cows live on the farm and everybody pays the farmer a little bit to take care of the cows. And maybe even they get stored there. And when that mobile facility comes in, it processes all the animals maybe over a couple weeks because those kind of people would love that steady level of work. I can't remember the gal's name. I'll try to find the episode if I can remember. But she said, you know, the biggest problem is how lumpy the workload is. Like you're working really hard for a couple of weeks and you're not, and you still have to pay for all your shit. So that might actually be really useful. And then Roke says, how about, let's say, Texas approved processing sites across the state lines? That federal gets involved immediately when something crosses the state line. That wouldn't work. Now, what has worked is some states have state-approved facilities, and that meat can be processed in the state and then sold through supermarkets and such in the state. The weakness of that model is that it's only going to be your smaller, like family-owned supermarkets and stuff, and like direct-to-consumer markets that will package and sell that stuff. And the reason is, all of them basically have a mafia representative from like Cargill, et cetera. They're not really in the producer side. They're in the distribution side. That's where they're like their second level mob enforcers are. And what they'll do is they'll basically tell that story. You bring that shit in, we'll cut you off. And they'll never give you enough to have enough. So you better not do that shit. I mean, it is a dirty mafia level business. All right, we got to move on though. We got a lot to cover today. I wanted to talk to you about this. I thought this was just the coolest little thing. I follow a group of chefs that run a restaurant out of England called Fallow, Fallow. And I have learned so much watching these guys' videos. These are like Michelin level chefs. I think their restaurant has like 2 Michelin stars. If you know anything about like high end restaurants, that's elevated as hell. They bake all kinds of stuff, and they'll take like this Michelin level dish that there's no way you're going to make it at home. And they'll show you, but this is what you make at home. This is the version of it you can make at home consistently. And they'll do the super elevated versions. And they did a whole series on British pub food. It was really cool. Anyway, I was watching some of their videos this week while I was doing my own food prep for the fall workshop. I was making you guys breakfast sausage. Those of you that are coming. And I'm set up with my patty press and my grinder and everything. And I'm just watching these guys. And this video of theirs comes up. And it's all these, they're like, it was called something like hacks that chefs actually use. Because, you know, YouTube is full of all these cooking hacks and shit that nobody actually does, right? But these, like, real chefs actually use these hacks. And what came up was when they do, like, over easy or over medium eggs, fried eggs, the way they make a bunch at a time, they don't fry them. Yep, they don't fry them. What they do is they put them in a pan, with shallow little cups in it, which I had never seen one of these pans before, but I got one for a year in a second. And they put the eggs in there and they put in the oven. And let me make sure I get the temps that they gave right. I haven't tried it yet, so you might need to experiment some. But it was, damn it. Anyway, the pan you use is called a muffin top pan. And I'm going to show you one here in a second. But 2.5 minutes at 320 Fahrenheit. I had to convert it out of centigrade for you guys. And I'm going to play with this. And I might honestly run mine a little bit longer than that. And the reason I would do that is I like an over medium. But the eggs came out perfect, perfectly round. And you could easily, if you like the kind of over easy look to them instead of a sunny side up look, you could then spoon some hot butter on them to get that kind of top coat if you really wanted to. But I've got a pan for those of you on the video. They're like $13, stainless steel. And I was like, what kind of pan is that? So I put egg baking pan in Amazon. And what I found is the pan, and this is exactly the, except theirs was 12 instead of 6, the exact kind of pan, stainless steel pans for making muffin tops. So muffin tops is, you know, the best part of the muffin, just the top. And it just looked really cool. And as soon as I saw it, I'm like, yeah, that's something I want to put, you know, a 3-minute, 2-minute segment on about it. I'll let you know how it works. If you've ever done that, let me know. I think this would be a great thing, especially if like you're doing brunch for a bunch of people. You could have the eggs all ready to go. The oven's doing other things. Drop your temp, pop the eggs in right before you serve, a little salt and pepper on them, make them look nice and taste good. Just a really cool, simple thing. And it, you know, if you eat a lot of eggs, it might be very, it might alter your course of existence just a little bit in a good way. And what it makes me think of is the first time I heard about and tried baking bacon. When I started making bacon in the oven, I'm like, I am never frying bacon again unless I have to for some reason. Because bacon out of the oven is beautiful. And if you do it with a nested cooling grid inside a half sheet pan, you end up with all the grease falling down. You put a piece of foil down there so that mess your nice pan up, and you get the most beautiful bacon grease for cooking. It doesn't get all charred like it does in dark. It stays snow white, and it's like pure flavored lard. So it's just so good for cooking. So this might be, like, I don't eat that many over easy eggs. I eat some, and so this might be just fun for me. But if you cook a lot of eggs for your family every week, this could be one of those things that just makes the life a little bit better forever by knowing one little tweak. So I'd love to hear from any of you guys that are doing this already. I know when I put out about bacon years and years ago, I'm like, where you been, Jack? I don't know. This one seems new to me. All right, now moving on, let's talk about Bitcoin a little bit. And I want to talk about Bitcoin in a way that most people don't. Just a cut and dry, nuts and bolts reality of investing in Bitcoin. So when people talk about having made a lot of money by investing in Bitcoin, everybody says, well, that's because you got in early, right? And when they say early, I mean, early's 2010, 2011, 2012, 2014, right? You know, go back 12 years, go back at least 10, maybe 14 years, right? Like, I bought my first Bitcoin in 2012. God, I wish I would have kept every sat I ever bought. I really do. But what if we only went back 5 years? 5 years ago, it was shockingly August of 2021, right? We were like well into the middle or past the midpoint of the scamdemic. Bitcoin had already made a big run in 2020. And I would teach people you should be buying Bitcoin every day, $5, $10 a day, DCA every day. That's the way, right? And every day with more sats than you started. And the number one excuse I got was what? Does anybody want to guess in the life thing? What was the number one excuse that I was given back just 5 years ago when I said buy Bitcoin? I missed the opportunity. Okay, I missed the opportunity. So I thought, hey, this would be fun. Let's just go back 5 years and see what would have happened, right? I said, and I ran scenarios in AI to make sure these numbers all checked out. Consider this and understand why I keep telling you to DCA every day. If a person invested $10 daily in a Bitcoin starting August 21, 2020, I went back to 2020, I went 6 years. Sorry, guys. All right. Through today, August 21, 2026, the exact results are Total money put in, $21,920 with 2,192 days consecutive investing. Your portfolio value today would be $64,650. By the way, I ran this before this big green candle. Summary stats, total invested, you'd have about 0.837 Bitcoin. So, you know, people say I'll never be a whole coiner. 6 years ago, $10 a day, you just keep doing it. You're at a 0.8 coin. You were very close, striking distance. Bitcoin total profit, $42,730 return of investment. ROI over those 6 years, 195% ROI, 195%. That even beats shitty inflation from Biden and Trump combined. 195% ROI in the last 6 years. I really, I guess I screwed that up. I really had meant to do that from 2021. I'm sure the numbers would still be good. Might even be a little bit better. Because here's something else I found for you. Now, if you did what I just said, it doesn't really, I think, shock anybody that 5-6 years you can have a, you know, a positive ROI with something like Bitcoin. But I want to show you something. This just happened to show this morning when I was putting the show together from a guy I follow or organization I follow called Wicked, Wicked Bitcoin on X. And he said, those who started DCAing at the all-time high are now in profit, the power of dollar cost averaging. And you can see that right there is your all-time high. And so a person who has been buying since the all-time high, which you would think is the worst time to start, wouldn't you? Right? Like the last thing you want to do is start buying at the top of the market. But even with that, with a DCA, it was less than a year for those people to turn from a losing buy to being profitable and quite so. Going forward now, that just keeps getting better, right? And again, if you've been doing this 6 years, if you've been doing this six years, is 195% ROI. Top Cone says, I opposed the daily buy because it was too expensive. When I finally did it, I now shake my head and wish I had started doing it years ago. I wish I had started doing it much earlier myself. But the reality is it's only about 5-6 years that we've had the ability to buy that small amount cost effectively anyway. And once we had that ability, that's when I started doing it. Once I realized, like, so I can buy $5. Well, hell, I'm doing this every day. And it, you know, people say it's expensive, but is it, right? The same person that says that has a $6 a day Starbucks habit and goes to the Roach Coach at lunch or goes to lunch at work every day and could easily find $5, $10 to do this with by giving up one thing that's kind of a luxury. Now, this includes holidays, weekends, everything if you're doing it right. But this is what I keep trying to get people to understand. Don't be afraid of the apparent expense. If you said, oh, I can invest $100 a month, and that made you comfortable with every first you pay $100, just divide it by 30, 333, whatever, you know, 333 a day, round up to $4. Okay? Whatever that monthly number is, just convert it to a daily number based on a 30-day month because you have shorter and longer months and just let it be and there'll be a couple extra here and there. And then just, you know, toward the point that the amount you've deposited in Strike, River, whatever is getting low, just throw in the next month's deposit like you're doing. So your money out of your bank account is the same. It's still once a month. Right. Maybe it's a week early so you don't have a buy fail. Right. I've had that happen a time or two over the years and I just made it up with extra buy. But there's something magical that happens. You wake up and Bitcoin just had this giant green candle and everybody's celebrating. You're going, oh, already? Damn. Why? And then when it goes down, everyone's like, oh, my God, the world's out. You're like, woohoo. And you just watch your daily sat increase go up. And it. You know, right now people are saying this new green candle is a bear trap, right? That means that, like a dead cat bounce where everybody jumps in because now it's coming back and then falls out the end. Now, I'm going to tell you that there's one guy that's going to get liquidated for like $20 million today if we hit 80K on it. And I don't know that he's going to get liquidated. I'm not going to say he's going to get liquidated. I personally think we're going to go back down before we go back up. I think the accumulation trough is in place, right? 77,000 or whatever sounds really high. It was 126 a year ago. The buying trough keeps getting higher as the all-time highs get higher with it. The power laws intact, et cetera. Anyway, it's up to you if you want to do this or not, but you know, this is just reality. Next, I want to talk really, really quick about Lindsey Clancy. Now, if you've been under a rock or you haven't heard this because you just don't listen to the news, which is probably good, I'll listen to it so you don't have to for you. Lindsey Clancy's a woman, Massachusetts, I think somewhere in New England, killed her two or three children, slit her own wrist, jumped out a window, and is now in a wheelchair. And she's now on trial for murdering her three children. Did she kill her three children? Yes, absolutely. Am I going to come out and say, throw her in prison for the rest of her life? No. Am I going to come out and say, send her to a psychiatric ward? Clearly, she's mentally unstable and it's not her fault. No. I want to talk today about how maybe some influencers in the world, like most of them, need to shut the fuck up more often and actually have more information before they go lipping off at the mouth. Right now, the internet is full of dumbass young women talking about how this poor woman is really the victim and she needs help and care and blah, blah, blah. And a bunch of dudes who don't know the fuck what's going on either talking about she needs to be in Rikers or wherever for the rest of her life. Here's how I feel about this. From a little bit I know that I don't know enough to have an opinion. However, I have concepts. And so my concept is she bears certainly some responsibility. There's no doubt about it. There's three beautiful lives were destroyed, and that's just that were killed. Like, you're talking grandparents and a father who turned out he's kind of a dick, but I mean, still nobody wants to bury their children. So all of the people connected to this share in this tragedy of having their life upended. I can't imagine having, you know, someone kill my two grandchildren, let alone their mother. I mean, the ripping and tearing of the heart. And yet her mother-in-law, right, said she begged for help and the system failed her. That buys a little bit with me. Maybe it doesn't buy, oh, it's okay, just send her off to the wacky ward for 2 years and it'll be fine. No, but and then have you seen the medication this woman was prescribed? And if you throw out like antihistamines and all, just actual psychotropic medication, it's like 16 different drugs in like a 6 month period. And most of them prescribed by the same doctor who is actually a nurse practitioner. I don't give a shit what the end result of this woman's trial is. That freaking person who wrote those freaking prescriptions bears some culpability here. Now, I didn't say they should go to prison forever. But I think the bigger takeaway from this is, and one thing we just need to understand, we have these trials. They go on for 3, 4, 5 weeks. We have testimony being presented by both sides during that time. The jury and the court know more than you ever will because the media will only bring you the sensational. Now, there's times where I have no problem issuing an opinion. Carmelo Anthony was one of those. Bro stabbed a guy to death. Period. Didn't need to. Murder. The end. Go out. Bye. Get a new trial. Don't shit. That's all I have to say because it's, to me, it's very cut and dry. This is not cut and dry. This is complex. And what we as a people need to work on is a comprehension of complexity. Not everything's binary. Not everything's cut and dry. Most things aren't. I don't know the real answer here. I'll wait and see. And I don't know if we'll ever know the truth. Somebody eventually will be doing some big book on it. And if you're that interested, you can dig in. I don't think that the precedent needs to be set here, though, that you can just claim you're crazy and get off basically scot-free because a mental institution isn't where you want to be, but it's a hell of a lot better than prison. And the thing about that type of a not guilty by reason of insanity, when you go to that facility, when the doctors in that facility say, we bless this person is no longer a danger to themselves or others, they walk. And I don't I don't know, but I think there's criminal behavior here beyond the woman. It doesn't mean hers isn't, right? So I'm sure I'm going to get an email from somebody that says, I just said that she should get away with it, and I'm going to delete your email because you're too stupid to respond to, if you get that out of what I just said. Moving on, let's talk about Lisa Murkowski, one of our favorite Rhino Republican senators from Alaska, who only has your job because of your daddy's name, bitch. Yeah, I said it. Okay. James O'Keefe, she wants him prosecuted. This is a Republican sitting senator. Here's what happened. James O'Keefe went to Alaska. James O'Keefe knows that Lisa Murkowski's brother lives here in Texas now. He's not an Alaska resident at all. He tells people there he's so-and-so Murkowski, and he left his driver's license at home or whatever. They offered him the ballot. They offered him a senator's brother's ballot with no ID. Of course, he didn't vote because that would be a crime. He documented it and said, look at what's happening. So Murkowski comes out and says, voter fraud is a crime. This should be investigated. Inferring that O'Keefe, in fact, I have her, I don't think this picture is directly related, but this is part of why I consider her one of many Senator Karens, just this face alone. This is one of the most useless people in our government. Not only is she a Republican in name only, I would say she'd be a Democrat in name only. She is a useless, empty pantsuit who does whatever the people that manage her tell her to do. I know that's many senators, but she wants O'Keefe. Here's James O'Keefe. You can watch the video yourself later. I won't play it here. He basically goes to the polling place, got a retard mask on, right? Only like COVID mask on, like an N95 one, tells him that he's this chick's brother, and they just try to give him the ballot. And whoever said there, Eric Daughtry, said, wait, Ms. Murkowski, you're more upset about the staged election interference than actual illegal aliens voting, figures for someone who's part of the problem, child caucus in the Senate. Yeah. This just tells you we're not going to fix this. Do you realize how absurd this really sounds? Let me just replay it for you here real quick, and we'll move on. A guy with a camera following him so they know he's being videoed, okay? Goes to a polling place, claims to be the brother of a sitting senator from that state to vote in the primaries, and with no ID, they give him that person's ballot. And then the senator calls on him to be prosecuted. Senator who's opposed to the Voter ID Act, called the SAVE Act. I mean, this sounds like the upside down, doesn't it, really? To me, that's what it sounds like. And I don't think we're fixing this, folks. That's why I did the segment. I have, like, the outline here on the segment that we did on beef today, like these creative ways around systems. I think that's what we're going to have to do on the beef thing, real quick, rehashing that. I meant to say I really think that in that model, what works even better than beef is lamb. And I know there's people have this dislike of lamb, and it's because you buy lamb in the store and you're buying a lamb that's from Australia or New Zealand that was shipped all the way across the Pacific Ocean and eventually got to you, and the way they're grazed and the processing time and all of that plays into what some of you call a gamey taste. That's no such thing as a gamey taste. There is no flavor in your, you have taste buds on your tongue. None of them are for gamey flavors. There's no such thing as gamey. There's an off flavor, right? Gamey indicates that anything that you would call game would have this flavor, right? That's not a thing. This is an off flavor. It doesn't belong there. If you have ever had domestically grass-fed raised lamb processed somewhere between 9 and about 13 months, it doesn't have any of that. You would be very hard-pressed to realize you're not eating beef, other than if you had like a rib chop, you would be looking at them and go, that's an awful small ribeye, man, right? But the flavor, the taste, the color, the way it cooks, the way it mimics things being done, like, you know, a medium is a medium, et cetera. Nah, man, it is freaking delicious. Some of the best meat you'll ever eat. The reason is the equipment necessary to process and the work necessary to process lambs, or even a little bit older, we get into sheep, we mutton. There is something. Can somebody help me out with this? I keep forgetting to look it up. Maybe somebody will have me an answer and I won't have to look it up. There is something you call lamb sheep meat when it's older than it can be to be called a lamb, but younger than where it has to be called mutton. There's something in the middle. I'd like to know what that is. Anyway, it's just, you know, I can process a lamb by myself in about 20 minutes. And to done, like to at least like, you know, broke down to primal subprimals. And then if I want to go down to double chops or something, it's another 15 minutes. I'm talking from the trigger pull till I'm drinking a beer, kicked back and done and ready to just like start using the vacuum sealer, less than an hour, not going in a hurry by myself. And I think that lamb for up to 364 days, somebody says hogget, H-O-G-G-E-T. I don't know, man. Somebody figure that out. Go ask AI or Google or some shit and let me know. So lamb is a lamb up to day 364. And the day it hits day 365, is it mutton or is it something else? Anyway, I just think it would be an easier model. And, you know, I say this having brought home half of a sheep lamb, a schlam, right, from John Willis's. It was like 13 or 14 months old. And it was a ram, and he was freaking delicious. I kick myself for not bringing a bigger cooler with me on that trip, because I took as much as I could shove into the damn thing. Anyway, moving on. Let's talk about a reverse Star Trek universe that you live in. That's a curveball from Jack on a day like today, right? A reverse Star Trek? Yes. So if you're a Star Trek fan, you understand post-scarcity universe. The idea is Star Trek looks like socialist utopia with a meritocracy bolted into it because everybody has food, shelter, medical care, all basic needs in abundance. And the viewpoint from the people that wrote this, and this is before it was butchered into Discovery and all this other crap, the Starfleet Academy woke shit. Like, you go back before that, when it actually kind of made sense, accepting that it's science fiction. When you get to a point where you can travel at the speed of light, basically produce as much energy as you want for next to nothing, and replicate food. So a hoggart is a sheep between 1 and 2 years old. Mutton is 2 years and older. Okay, good. I learned something today. And everybody did, I think, right? Except for maybe the one person that knew it, hoggart. Anyway, so once you're in that place, when you can push a button and have food replicated, and I'm like, oh, yeah, it's synthetic. It's science fiction, chill. Then once you have that much capability because you have so much energy available and the ability to manipulate matter to, like, replicate a house or replicate a steak, then there is no need for anybody to go hungry because you have so much abundance, you're post-scarcity. What if I told you we are already post-scarcity in reality? There is no shortage of anything. From a material standpoint, we do not have a shortage of land. We do not have a shortage of building materials. And we do not have a shortage of types of structures that can be built for people to inhabit. Yeah, we could be building houses for people cheap right now. Comfortable, in some ways, way better housing than we live in. Because sticks and bricks and freaking drywall is a mold incubation factory that most people live in. And if you've ever looked at a house that's over 70 years old, unless it was meticulously maintained, they don't even last a full human lifetime. And if they do, nobody wants to live in them by the end. Okay? So we could do that. Why don't we? Government. That's the only answer. Minimum square footage, minimum lot size, all this other layered shit that prevents us from building inexpensive housing quickly. Okay. We don't have a food shortage. We already talked about that. Why is beef expensive? Because you can't get it processed. I promise you that the average rancher who has cut back his cow-calf herd and cut his headcount and is producing less beef today, if he could easily sell off that beef, not even direct to consumer, but one layer, so that he got more per cow, right, would be selling for at a price to that processing facility, who would be selling to that customer, the customer would pay less, the processor would make a fair profit, and the rancher would make more. And once you're in a position where every cow equals more all the time, you grow your herd till that's either your land can't support it or that's not true anymore, which is what they did until the government created. You go to every place that we apparently have a scarcity, and you will find government. Scarcity in like access to medical care. Oh, yeah, okay. All right. Take all the people who are at all these clinics and doctor's offices who are on Medicaid, who go down there every time they stub a toe because they don't have to pay for it. People like my wife told me a story about a woman that came in because her daughter had a headache and a little bit of a like achy fever, cold type thing. And the doctor told her all she needs is some Tylenol. Why the nurse that you set the appointment with kind of told you that. Why did you bring her in today? If you ride it, it's free. Tylenol? Like $4 worth of Tylenol? And this doctor, who's not a doctor anymore, probably because of comments like this, said, I noticed you smoked. Maybe you could not smoke for one day and buy your kids some Tylenol. Right. That is a manufactured governmental scarcity. Keep going. Everything that you think is scarce is actually abundant. The one thing we have in abundance in this country is money. And it always comes back to that. You can have scarce money and abundant things, or abundant money and scarce things. Because since you have abundant money, not only are more dollars chasing the same amount of goods and services, once you have abundant money, the government can start packing layers in so that all their people that they serve, the real people, because it ain't you, can profit off of the layers. So the inspectors in the beef factories and them are protecting Cargill because we have to, they're an American institution, right? We can't, what poor babies, they might have to compete. We don't want that. You live in a world of manufactured scarcity. We do not have scarcity in the world today. We have a government problem, not a scarcity problem. Just another way to think about it. All right. Now I meant to do this last week. I'm going to try to give you like one thing out of one of my laws every week until I go through all 30 laws. So we're going to do Laws of Life, Book 2, Law 1 today, but just a piece of it. Because I think when you hear the laws, a lot of times like, oh, everybody knows that. But they're very multi-layered. So Law 1 in Book 2 is do what you hate, but do it like you love it. And it has something buried in that chapter that I call the ABC 123 method of time management. Now, there are very expensive software programs to help you manage your time. There are incredibly intensive project management certifications to learn how to manage time. There's all sorts of material that's out there in this one space that you can invest a lot of time and money in to better manage your time. I'm about to give you my time management method. I used this and I passed it down to my sales force when I was managing a sales force of 38 people doing $200 million in revenue. So I've used it as an entrepreneur at home by myself, and I've used it as a regional vice president of sales. I used it as a COO when I worked with Neil Franklin. Okay, same method, and that's what I would teach like all our corporate recruiters. I had them on this method, and it's very simple. And it does come off of do what you hate, but do it like you love it, but it gets kind of a multiplier and a structure. And all you have to do this is build yourself in, you know, sheets or Excel or whatever, any kind of spreadsheet program. Just a very simple spreadsheet. And it's basically two columns, and you can make it more elaborate if you want. And one is the task and the other is the priority number. And then once you just go through your week and then on the fly enter the priority code. And then do sort ascending, and all your tasks are in order of how you should do them. And you will naturally have to do what you hate first. Here's how it goes. Priority one items, right? These are your 1A, 1B, 1C. That's why it's the 1-2-3 ABC method. If you don't do it, something really bad happens. On my farm, fish are going to die. Birds are going to die. Something broke. When I had a job, if I lose this client, I'm going to get fired, right? So The things that fell under that, that's a 1A. That's a dead set first thing you're going to do. 1B, anything that's not that much of a threshold, but it needs doing today, okay, or in this cycle, is a 1B. So the tiebreaker, anything that would go in category 1, the tiebreaker between B and C is basically the things I don't want to do become a B. If I look at that and go, I want to do that, B, immediately, done, right? And then 1C, I need it done before a priority 2 item can happen. So it needs to get done because as I move down my list, there are things that come next that can't happen till this one happens, right? So that's 1A, B, and C. Yep. Priority 2 items. This absolutely must be done by the end of the cycle. I don't need it today, but whatever, it's either this day, this week, this month, this thing must be done, 2A. I don't hate it. Nothing super bad is going to happen, and it's not critical to the next step in the chain, right? 2B, an ongoing task or project will be completed by doing this. I don't need it right now, but it has to happen in this. 2 means it has to happen in the cycle we're putting together. And if I do this one thing, something else is like a whole project is finished. It's a close item, right? And then 2C, this needs to be done before a priority 3 task can happen. So anything that's in priority 3, if it's held up by something, it goes to 2C. Priority 3, anything I would really like to have done in this time period. I want this, but if it's I'm planning a week or a month, it's not the end of the world. It can go to the next cycle. And then anything on top of that, that really is a nice to have. It's not just something I'd really like to have done. It'd be like, if I get everything else done, I'll do this too. That's a 3C. And all you do is you make that simple spreadsheet, sit down on a Monday. It's Monday mayhem, right? So Monday less mayhem. Task your week out that way, okay? Every day during the week, new shit comes in. Add it to the spreadsheet, code it, and just keep working. Do that for a month and get back to me and tell me what happens to your life. And I'll tell you why. And this is a big thing that the law is about because it's very this chapter is like 30 pages or something, right? It's a simple little law. But the reality is that when we do things, we instinctively – we'll prioritize things we'd rather do than things we'd rather not do. That's just human nature. We don't like the suck, so we try to avoid the suck. Yeah? So instead of avoiding the suck, embrace the suck. But do it in a formal way because you do not have enough willpower to do this. You don't. If you did, you wouldn't need it. I'll do it. No, you won't. You will find some reason. Somebody come by your desk and say, "Had," and you're like, "Oh, God, that's an interesting project." And all of a sudden, what should be a 1B is a 2C. And then you're breaking your neck to get it done at the end of the week. But when we do the suck first, daily, weekly, monthly, doesn't matter. It's like riding a bicycle up a hill. Once you get over that thing you don't want to do, boom, it's balls to the wall because what's left is the things that you at least are okay. Like, you don't, maybe you're not, woohoo, I get to do it, but you're like, I want to do this. I'm okay doing this. Yeah. It's very simple, and it's so simple. It's so freaking simple. And this is a trap, and this is why I brought this up today. It's the same thing with Bitcoin. Well, I got to do this, that, no, DC every day. That's it. Don't look at it. Don't even look at the price. Don't worry about it. Just do it, and it'll take care of itself, right? We have this compulsive need as humans to fuck with stuff. I got to do this. I got to do that. No, you have a mission in life, whether you're an entrepreneur, whether you are, you know, a worker, a senior worker, a lower level. You have things that you need to get done, right? So you got to do those things. You prioritize them the way I gave you, and you do them. And then just watch what happens, all right? All right. With that, I am kind of wrapped up. Do want to remind you guys about a few things. One is our item of the day today. I talked a little bit about cutting meat and processing meat today. Well, Victorinox has their 6-inch semi-stiff boning knife. Stop it, you guys, doing the Beavis and Butthead commercials. He said stiff, right? Like, look, it's what it's called. It's basically a fillet knife with a little bit more backbone than a typical fillet knife. 6-inch blade, swept up, great ergonomic handle. These things are on sale today for like $27 or something like that. I own 3 of these. I own one of the big breaking knives, but I own 3 of these because That way, whichever one is sharpest at any given time, I pick it up and then I sharpen them all when I get to it. I use this every time I'm breaking down chicken, every time I'm trimming a primal. About the only thing I use the breaking knife for is like I'll buy a big rib primal and cutting my steaks out of a big rib primal. But when it comes to all the trim work, all the fine work, all the finesse work, all the deboning, this is the knife. And let me tell you something about this knife. When I first brought this out about 4 or 5 years ago, I had a multitude of people that were professional meat cutters say, not only do I use that knife, when I went to school to learn meat cutting, they gave me that knife. This is the number one used knife by professional meat cutters, period. This knife right here. When I went up to Crunchy Mama Farm, Sean up there, and he had, you know, this guy worked in a processing facility for a lot of his life. Now he teaches on-farm processing. When he brought out the box of knives for everybody, and we went through the little belt sharpener and sharpener, guess what they were? Most of them were this. There were some bigger ones, some breaking knives and stuff, but most of the knives, the students were this knife. So when it's on sale, pick up one, pick up two. If you have a good honing steel, you keep that edge really true for quite a long time before it needs to go on a belt or a stone. And every once in a while, it needs to go on a belt or a stone. And I mean, at $27, if this knife's not in your kitchen, I'm not really sure why you don't have one. You should get one. It belongs in your kitchen. Unless, I guess you don't, if you don't cut meat and fish, then you don't need this. The other thing I want to remind you about, and this is important, because we're one day away. In fact, we're not even a full day away anymore. We are 22 hours, 20 minutes, and 9 seconds from enrollment opening for the Jack's Laws ChatGPT Entrepreneurs AI course. We will open that tomorrow morning. If you click on our links and you can go to Jack's Laws and you can sign up, or you can go to this page right here, which is jackslaws.com/countdown. And this will be the link that we send out tomorrow. I'm going to put it up on the screen for everybody here that's on the screen. Again, jackslaws.com/countdown. If you go there, you can fill out a form. We will email you, I think about Tom has it set up to like 15 minutes before enrollment begins. And that way, when enrollment opens, you guys can sign up. I'll be putting it out on social and all, but the last couple of times this course sold out completely. If you want to build a business in this world today, you're going to need two things: a properly structured business from a standpoint of marketing, gaining leads, doing follow-up, having a standard operating procedure in your business so it becomes scalable, and you're going to have to use AI. Because if you don't use AI, you're going to compete with people that are going to use AI. This course gives you both. I basically took my consultancy work that I did for marketing and sales with a little bit of business operations added in, and then married it to AI so that you could afford to have the type of results I could have gotten you 15, 20 years ago when I used to charge a lot of money to do this. $300 and take your course. And I've always had if you want your money back, tell us. I've never had anybody ask for it. I haven't had a single person ask for their money back. I will tell you, there are people that don't complete the work, but they know that's on them. And the beauty of this, I just had somebody email us and say, hey, I want to take the course again. How can I make sure I can get in? You can't make sure you can get in, but you don't need to. If you take the course, you can retake it every time we run a thing. And when we add things to it, you get it for free. This is something that's really worth doing. And you're living in a world, again, just look at the debt. $40 trillion in debt. What you're going to have to be able to do is produce for yourself in the future. So even if you don't have a business yet, if you at least know what business you want to be in and what product or service you want to market, this will get you off the ground and to a running start. I do want to say a little bit about what's not in it. Exactly how to file your files, right, or how to do your taxes, not in this, okay? I don't know why some people seem to think that that belongs in there. It's not in there. How to build a website, not in there, right? Like, the way you build a website today is you use WordPress and you build it, or you pay somebody to put it together for you. And then with this, you generate content for it, because if you do that, it's very easy to add things to your site on your own. You don't become dependent on a developer, because you don't want that to happen. So if you want to be in this course, now is the time. I think I only had one thing I started today. This came from Sam Kenny. Ah, it's Ken Daniels. comment. Besides side hustle and skill stack, I've learned working for and butchering for local processors, take a problem and become a solution. Chef Ken. That's another great point. Like, so Ken's a great chef, but I don't think he was really like a super badass processor of meat from whole animal down to primal down to cut. You know how he got good at it? He went and started, I think he got paid eventually, but I think he started out just like, I'll come help to learn. And so any skill set you're lacking, there's probably a way that you can learn it if you're willing to go out and pay for it with your labor. And man, what a great skill to have. And I think that it's one of those skills that I take a little bit for granted what I can do with a knife, because I processed my first deer, like skin it, take care of it by myself when I was 14 years old. Like, there's the deer. You've seen it once. Go do it. It was slow. It was laborious. It took a lot of time. It was winter. It's Pennsylvania. I'm out in the shop. My fingers hurt, but I got it done. And once I did that, I was like, I can do that half time next time. I'll take half the time to do it. And the time after that, I could do it in, you know, about 20%, 25% of my original time to do it. And I got to where I actually enjoy it. And I think if I did it every day, like as a profession, that would go away. There's a lesson in that too. But when it comes to like, you know, I just this weekend for you guys for the fall workshop coming up, I made another 16 pounds breakfast sausage. And I'm talking, I ground it, seasoned it, mixed it, put it through my patty press and fried. This is all pre-cooked. So our cooks just have to set them in pans and warm them up for you guys for that breakfast. It's going to be biscuits and gravy and sausage and eggs, right? So, I mean, I enjoyed doing that. I don't want to do it every weekend, but I enjoyed doing that too. Oh, by the way, I also finally broke down and bought my ass a 1-horsepower Cabela's carnivore grinder. And let me say this. I am big on frugality. You guys know that. If there's something that really will make your life flow better, that requires an investment, but you can afford it, it's just like $600+ for a grinder when I'm a little $150 turbo force for 10 years, right? Like, and all I can think after I used it the first time, you dumbass, you should have bought that thing 10 years ago when you bought that cheap ass little grinder. Cheap ass little grinder is fine, but the last time I put meat through it, I swear to God, it said, I'm tired, boss. I'm tired. I'm just tired, boss. And so it can go to grinder heaven now. Maybe I'll give it to somebody. I'd never trade it or charge anybody anything for it because I don't know how much life it's got left in it. Let me tell you that, too. If you're going to sell something used and you're iffy on it, be honest about that, but also don't sell it to a friend because your friend will always associate you with it dying after they bought it. Anyway, that wraps it up for the day. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Another couple reminders as I sign off. One, I will be in Charleston, West Virginia this Saturday. Yes, the 29th of August. I'll be doing the keynote speech at the West Virginia Home Educators Conference that's in Charleston. And we're doing a meetup at Brick and Salt Restaurant at my hotel, which is, I think it's Marriott Town Center. But there's details on the website. If you want to come, I'll make sure that we keep putting that out this week. I'll add it to the Daily Mail and stuff like that for you guys as well. But if you want to come to the conference, you can get tickets for that. If you want to come to the meetup, you can come to that or you can come to both. And as I said before, I can't go visiting people or anything like that or doing anything outside of that plan because I fly in Friday evening. I present Saturday. I got the meetup Saturday evening and then Sunday morning I'm out. So just so you guys know, I'm not being rude when I turn you down. And when I travel, I usually turn you down anyway because I'm usually with my family. And we also, again, have the AI course coming up. And again, check out the book. If you like the little stuff I gave you on time management today, that book is gold. I know it's kind of egotistical for me to say that about my own book, but the more work I do with it in developing the course that goes with it, and I'm working on that. I'll get that done in September, I promise. The more I realize the levels of those two books together. So Laws of Life by Jack Spirko, book 1 and 2, really recommend the hard copy for you on that just because it's a better reading experience. With that, take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with a more typical.
Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month. You never have to pay. There's a better
a better way.